This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Yesterday, President Bush made his sixth veto. He nixed a multi-billion-dollar health and education spending bill. The president argued that bill was wasteful, but he gave a thumbs up to a $40 billion increase in the defense budget. That boost means that the defense budget now tops the average yearly spending during the Cold War. For more, we've got Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators. He's also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. And Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to be with you.
So, Ron, what exactly was in this bill, estimated at over $600 billion? We're talking the health and education bill.
Well, this is a very important bill. This is one of the most contentious appropriations bills. Congress has an obligation every year to pass, of course, budgets and the appropriations that fund the United States government. This specifically related to programs for labor, health, and human services. But this was a pork-laden bill. There were over 2,000 pork projects in the bill. For example, a project that would fund a school for a catamaran. There were all sorts of interesting projects put in for members of Congress that ultimately went well over the president's budget request for this fiscal year. So while the president is very much in favor of education programs and making sure that we have a safety net for our seniors and our at-risk population for health care, he objected to some of the high levels of spending and vetoed it. And it will be very interesting now, right before the Thanksgiving break, to see if the Democrats hold forth in their promise to withhold funds for the war. So it's going to be a very interesting next couple of days.
Now, Ron, before I move on to Mary, defense bills are not exactly known as pork-free, are they?
No, they're not. And in fact, this bill was a little bit higher than the president's initial funding request. And some people are going to say, well, goodness, you know, the labor and the education bill was only $10 billion above the president's request, and he vetoed it. And yet the defense bill was a little bit higher, and he signed it. And the distinction here is a very important one. The United States is at war. We need to make sure that our soldiers and our airmen and Marines and those who wear the uniform, both here and abroad, have the resources necessary. And that is the distinction the president was making for vetoing one and signing the other.
Mary, do you think that this decision to make one veto and to sign one bill will work in the president's favor, will work in Congress's favor? Where does the fight go from here?
It depends on how much the public pays attention and remembers. If they remember that year after year, the Republican-controlled Congress increased and busted the budget, and Mr. Bush signed every single bill, never vetoed a one, which really irritated some of my Republican relatives who are fiscal conservatives, and that he drained the entire surplus that was there when he came in office, then they will be look at this askance and wonder what the politics happen to be. And here's the politics. The politics is that there are things that people call pork in each one of these bills. But one man's pork is another man's necessary item. And because the Democrats now have a policy that was passed in the Congress for earmarks to be disclosed, you can go to a website and look to see who wanted a specific program. Every single thing that's in the HHS, the health bill, there's job training, there is heating assistance for the homeless, there's more money for cancer research. There are all kinds of things that had been neglected during the last years when the Congress controlled the Congress, and now they're in there. But you can see earmarks that one can laugh at without knowing what they are. If there's catamaran or whatever it is, I don't know whether a Democrat or Republican did that. So there are earmarks from both sides, and some of it is job training things. There are distressed districts where people have constituents who want things in their district. Whether it works or not depends on how much people are aware, and it's good strategy for Mr. Bush, though, because he's assuming that the party has to have something to run on, and now they can switch and be fiscal conservatives, and nobody will remember anything that ever happened before, and all people will hear is pork, 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 and that will be what will get them through the next election.
Ron, what about this whole idea of what constitutes a fiscal conservative? Because the president has been criticized by some analysts within the Republican Party for spending too much. What's your analysis of the spending patterns of the administration? What goes forward, what doesn't?
Well, I was a proud member of the administration for the first 3.5 years, and one specific example that I wish the president had vetoed several years back was the Farm Bill. We have a constituency in the country now where people are being paid not to farm. People who make their livelihoods doing anything other than farming are receiving subsidy payments, and the bulk of the mom-and-pop farms, if you will, in this country received little or no money. And as a fiscal conservative and one who is strongly in favor of the president's policies, that was one specific example where I said, for goodness sakes, if we're a party that stands for fiscal responsibility, we need to exercise the veto pen. But in this particular case, Farai, I have to tell you, and to share this with Mary, it's not just $22 billion over the president's request this year. Over 5 years, what the Democrats propose to do is to increase spending by $205 billion. They don't want to enact the president's tax cuts that have really stimulated the economy. And I think that's the hallmark of a fiscal conservative, of keeping taxes low, generating jobs, continuing to create jobs for the American economy, and not stifling creativity while having these earmark-laden bills. So, it's been one that the president could have exercised his veto pen, but I'm glad that he's pulled it out, and I hope he continues to use it.
And we're using the term earmarks, which is a Capitol Hill phrase for these little pet projects that people put in. And as you mentioned, Mary, some of them seem very logical and necessary, and other ones seem a little off base.
Yeah, there are some, you know, even Republicans put a lot of them in that defense bill. There's one in there for one Republican district for a manufacturer to test gloves, and that's because the factory that is at risk in that community is a place that people rely on for jobs, and they want to give them contracts so that they can continue to function. So there are things you can poke fun at without knowing what they are. But most of them, the members who put them in, and now we know who they are, are willing to stand up in public and say that these are things we need.
Before we move on to some presidential politics, just want to get a sense from each of you about what is the future of good governance? And I know that's a broad question, but specifically speaking about earmarks, do people pay attention to this? And I'm talking about citizens, not just people on Capitol Hill.
We're going to find out. Oh, Ron. Okay.
Go ahead, Mary.
Go ahead.
We're going to find out in this election cycle, because as Mr. Bush continues to veto bills and the Congress keeps either failing or succeeding in overriding them, depending on what they are, and it becomes an issue, there'll be more talk about earmarks and pork and all the rest of that. And we'll find out whether anybody pays attention. And if they do pay attention, I read a study last week that somebody did that said that the public in the districts like earmarks because they bring things to the district. And so we're going to find out in the election cycle.
Ron?
And you know, I think Mary's absolutely right there. I do believe that the public is paying attention. This Congress now is unpopular now as Newt Gingrich's Congress was nearly a decade ago. People want the Congress to take care of their business, which is passing budgets on time, dealing with appropriations bills, and not getting into partisan bickering. And we saw the public was fed up with that when the Republicans controlled the Congress in the mid-1990s, and I think that they're fed up with it now with the Democrats. They want Congress to do their business, and Mary's right. Hey, if it's an earmark or if it's a project or a plant coming to my hometown of Palo Alto, California, I'm all for it. But if it's something in Louisiana, I might call that pork. But I think people just expect their leaders in Washington to stop all this fighting and sniping and just get their work done.
All right. Well, I want to reintroduce the topic and the players. We are talking politics. This is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We've got Ron Christie, vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and a former special assistant to President George W. Bush, plus Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Now, Mary, I'm going to take us to the campaign trail.
All right.
This week, the GOP candidate Fred Thompson got the endorsement from the National Right to Life Committee. Now, none of the mainstream Republican candidates have had a consistent record of opposing abortion rights. So why do you think he got that support?
Well, they say that they think he can beat Giuliani. They announced that, which was kind of interesting. They said this is the guy we think can beat Giuliani, and Giuliani is pro-abortion in their view, and that he was the only one who opposed stem cell research as well as abortion, even though he's not in favor of a constitutional amendment to outlaw it. And so they were picking the guy who they think has the right views. They thought Romney was inconsistent. You know, he's gone. A flip-flopper. They didn't use those words. But they then think that this is the guy and that McCain supports stem cell research. So Thompson is their guy. He's number second in the national polls that have come out recently. He's ahead of McCain and the rest. So maybe they think he is the guy who's going to take on Giuliani, and they're going to help him.
There doesn't seem to be any one evangelical groundswell for one candidate. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani got the endorsement of Pat Robertson last week. Why do you think, Ron, that there's not any one candidate who's sweeping up the evangelical endorsements?
Well, I think the natural candidate for the evangelical community would be former Governor Mike Huckabee, you know, an ordained Baptist minister, someone who's been consistently pro-life on the social issues, but he is one that has been criticized for raising taxes while he was governor of Arkansas, and that's an issue that is very important to the social conservatives as well. Governor Romney, as Mary has pointed out, has been perceived as being slightly inconsistent. I just don't think at the end of the day, though, that the social issue such as abortion is going to be the driving issue for the Republican nominee for president this year. I think it's going to be their stance on fiscal policy, and I think it's going to be their stance on defensive issues. But I have to tell you, as a longtime conservative, Fred Thompson would have been about the last person I would have thought the pro-life community would have endorsed.
Well, let's move on, actually, to something that's also tied into presidential politics. The Giuliani campaign is receiving some flack following the 16-count indictment against former police commissioner Bernard Kerik. Last week, Giuliani said Kerik has done a lot more good than bad during his career. Giuliani also supported Kerik's 2004 bid to head the Department of Homeland Security. So is this – why is he going back to that well, Mary, to re-endorse someone who's in such trouble?
Well, Kerik is important to the second piece of Giuliani's message. His first message is, I'm the 9/11 guy who'll save you from terrorism, period. Then his message is, I cleaned up New York and my police commissioner, Bernie Kerik, was the guy who was right there. And Kerik is his business partner. So, in fact, they have business dealings together, and apparently they may be even friends, as far as I know. But we know these things. And so his record in New York, cleaning up the city domestically, in part rests on Kerik, although Kerik didn't really do it. Anybody who followed it know it was a guy named Bratton, who was the police commissioner before Kerik, who actually cleaned. I followed that because I had hearings on it when I was chair of the Civil Rights Commission. He was the guy who actually did it, and Kerik came in. So, but he has to hang on to him because he's his friend, he's his colleague, and he was his police commissioner. I don't know how much it will hurt Giuliani or not. The guy's been indicted, of course, and there are news stories today about relationships he had and all sorts of things. But I don't think Giuliani is going to throw him over the side. He's going to hope that the 9/11 argument overcomes everything, just as it has gay rights, abortion rights, and everything else, and hang on to Kerik.
Now, these charges include things like tax fraud and conspiracy, corruption. These are not jaywalking against the light kind of charges. Ron, is Giuliani taking a real risk in remaining loyal to this former colleague?
Well, I think it says a lot about his character that he's sticking beside his friend and sticking beside his colleague. But I agree 1,000% with what Mary said. Rudolph Giuliani is inextricably linked to two things. One is 9/11, and two is cleaning up New York City and making it a place for people to come and visit and to spend money again. And in both of those instances, Bernie Kerik was at his right hand. And it makes the argument of the company that you keep. And if Mr. Kerik, if these allegations are proven true, then, of course, I think the question is going to be, what did the mayor know and when did the mayor know it? And I think that the mayor has done a fantastic job as mayor and as U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. But when you're so closely associated with someone who has these ethical allegations and these criminal allegations that have been lodged against him, in this tight era and at this tight race, that could make the difference of putting a Romney or putting someone else to leapfrog right up in front of Giuliani because of those ethical issues associated with his friend.
Let's move to the Democratic side of the presidential race. You've had the leading candidates staking out different turf. Edwards staked claim on Hurricane Katrina recovery efforts. Clinton has health care initiatives. And now Obama appears to try to corner the internet market. He's visiting Silicon Valley today to talk about some technology and innovations in his campaign. One is a proposal for a chief technology officer. The person would look after live webcasts of government meetings and develop the use of wikis and blogging software to communicate with Americans. Is this a gimmick? Is this important? Ron, what do you think?
Well, I think Senator Obama, more than any other candidate in either party, has harnessed the power of the internet. I think he has one of the best websites and has one of the best resources of information for people who are seeking information about his campaign. And, of course, he's raised more money than anybody else on the Democrat side of the ledger, at least, for campaign contributions. So I think Senator Obama has looked at the internet and said, this is my little corner of the world. This is something I should run on. And former Governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, has done much the same thing. Of he has a very impressive website, but specifically sticking to Mr. Obama, yes, I do think that he feels he can distinguish himself from his other candidates and his other rivals for his technological prowess, and I think he's done a great job with it.
Now, there's a lot of money in them there hills, the rolling hills of Palo Alto, which you hail from, Ron. So it's, I'm sure that it's some very useful fundraising territory as well. But sticking with the idea of technology, Howard Dean used technology, didn't get him the nomination. Mary, is this something that can make or break a campaign? Or?
Well, let me just tell you, first of all, the technology officer is a gimmick, but that's okay because you don't need to do that to do all these things. So it's nice to announce you're going to have this. Gimmicks are important in campaigns. Secondly, yes, Howard Dean did do that, but the Obama campaign says that they've learned from the Dean campaign that not only are they using the internet and rousting people, but they have boots on the ground with campaign volunteers out in Iowa and elsewhere, and that they're investing a lot in that aspect of its campaign, which does not rely on technology and getting out the vote. But we're going to find out how many people actually come out. The Obama campaign has done wonderfully. I predicted that they would all go negative and that they would continue to go negative if it made any dent in the front runner. And they made a slight little dent in the front runner. And now he is going to show what all of his new proposals are. But whether or not the internet saves the day for him will depend on if he goes beyond Dean's strategy and does, in fact, has a volunteer face-to-face, one-on-one strategy with people in Iowa and a different strategy in New Hampshire after that.
Well, Mary and Ron, thank you both so much.
Pleasure
thank
as you. Always. Mm-hmm.
Mary Frances Berry is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. Ron Christie is vice president of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. They spoke with us from NPR's Washington, D.C. headquarters.